The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Rochelle Saunders, guest hosting for Desiree Shell. Boobs. Knockers. Tatas. Hooters. Yes, today we are talking about breasts. How they may have evolved, the ways we alter them, the diseases that strike them, and even the bras we use to hold them up. Later on, Desiree Shell will be talking with science blogger Cy Curious about a recent French study that asks whether wearing bras actually helps keep our breasts perky, or if they might actually be dragging us down. But first, I'm joined by Florence Williams, a contributing editor at Outside Magazine and an award-winning freelance writer for The New York Times, New York Times Magazine, Slate, and Mother Jones, among many others. She's here today to talk about her first book, Breasts, A Natural and Unnatural History, which was named a notable book of 2012 by The New York Times and has been nominated for a Los Angeles Times Book Prize. Florence, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Okay, so this book was a fascinating read from cover to cover. But before we get into that, what prompted you to write this book in the first place?
Well, I was nursing my daughter, and as a science journalist, I was very curious and sort of disturbed to hear research reports of toxic chemicals in breast milk. I wanted to tell the story, and I decided a good way to do it would be to test my own breast milk. I actually got an assignment from the New York Times Magazine, and that's really what started this book. We sent my breast milk to a lab in Germany. We looked for a number of compounds, including flame retardants, which I found in my breast milk, and a jet fuel ingredient, and pesticides.
So one of the things that comes through loud and clear throughout your entire book is how little we actually know about the breast, which I found remarkable. Why don't we know very much about it?
The obvious reason to that is that we are so obsessed with how breasts look. You know, we get overwhelmed by the visuals. And because we sexualize breasts so much, I think it really does inhibit our kind of looking into them more deeply from a scientific perspective. If you look at even the anthropology of breasts, you know, sort of why we have them in the first place and how they evolved, even that becomes politically complicated in terms of who's asking the question and who's doing the looking. Because it turns out that a lot of men who want to study breasts just assume that sexual interest in breasts is universal and has been through all time. And so it really colors the way some anthropologists see breasts. And it wasn't until really feminists started entering the field of anthropology that they started questioning some of those assumptions. And so we just see this sort of permeating all these other fields, medical fields, scientific fields, research fields. Everything about the breast seems to get kind of subsumed by the way they look.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about human breasts, because what I didn't realize until your book kind of made me think about it was that human breasts are quite a bit different from other mammalian counterparts. Nobody really has them like we do.
Yeah, that was one of the things that really surprised me in writing this book. I just figured, well, all mammals have mammary glands, right? But it turns out that our breasts are really unique. And that's because we get them at puberty, and then we have them really our entire adult lives. Whereas other primates, for example, only have kind of swellings on their chests while they're lactating. And then those swellings flatten out after lactation. So it's kind of an interesting question as to, you know, well, why are ours so different? Or as I say in the book, how did we get so lucky?
In your book, you talk about different ideas as to how human breasts actually evolved. And there's actually some conflicting ideas here.
So the dominant theory for most of the last 50 years has been that breasts must be a sexual signal, and they must be a sexually selected trait. In other words, they exist to provide information to potential mates. And perhaps they tell a potential mate about how fertile we are, or that we're mature enough to carry a pregnancy, and that these breasts are visually so interesting because men like to look at them, and that must be why we have them. But competing theories to that are, well, maybe instead of being sexually selected, maybe breasts are naturally selected. meaning maybe they somehow improved our survival fitness or that of our infants. And so maybe there's something about the unique human breast shape that actually conferred a survival advantage. And as I said, this was really posited mostly by women entering the fields of anthropology who said, you know, maybe breasts exist for something other than just men. Maybe, you know, we really need those extra few percentage points of fat because we know breasts are very fatty. And we know that humans actually need more fat on their bodies to sustain a pregnancy and then to lactate an infant than other primates. And we also know that the human infant has greater fat requirements because of our much larger brains than other infants. And so the theory is really that breasts sort of help get us over, you know, the edge, as it were, for reaching these fat requirements.
You talked a little bit as well about the idea that the shape of the breast may have evolved in its particular way, in part due to the baby's face shape. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, this was posited by an anthropologist in England who happened to be breastfeeding her own baby. And as she did so, some light bulbs went off for her. And she started looking at the shape of the infant head, which is really different from the shape of other primate heads. The face is much flatter. And so she sort of posited this image of what happens if a baby with a flat face is breastfeeding on sort of a flatter breast. And it would be like kissing a mirror. You know, it would be kind of hard to breathe. It would be hard to do. And so because the infant's face is sort of flat, you know, it made sense to have this more protuberant sort of nipple and more protuberant breast. And then in addition to that, we have to hold our infants' heads up. They can't hold their own heads up, which other mammals can do. And so we have to sort of hold the infant in the crook of our arm. And so it was actually very helpful to have this kind of movable feast of a nipple, you know, that could really move around. If you think about it, in other mammals and in certainly other primates, the infant can actually cling to the mother because, you know, they're all covered in fur. But we just can't do that. So we needed kind of a breast that was a little more flexible.
Most other mammals have some kind of snout that allows them to kind of get at something that's flatter.
Exactly. And really, I've learned a lot about what happens with other mammals' mammary glands. And they're all really very unique to their particular species. There are some primates that have their nipples so close together that the infant can actually suckle both nipples at once. And the manatee has nipples under her arms. The eye-eye monkey has nipples towards the rear end. So it's, you know, it's really very species dependent and it's pretty unique.
I had no idea there was such diversity of nipple location.
And but there's even, I think the animal with the greatest number of nipples has 26 nipples. There's an awful lot of nipples out there.
There were also a couple of theories you mentioned that are, shall we say, a bit more far-fetched.
Yes. One Israeli anthropologist posited that the reason women have large breasts is to counterbalance her large bottom. So that she wouldn't just topple over. And of course, my sister-in-law jokes that that's the reason in her case.
So of the two theories that aren't so out there, is there one that's sort of the front runner right now?
It's still sort of controversial. There's still a lot of people out there who think breasts must be sexually selected. And in fact, if you sit in on a college first year anthropology class, that's probably what you'll hear. But which surprises me because I think the other theories are, you know, giving it a run for their money, especially the one about just fat content. We know that our breast tissue, especially human breast tissue, is filled with estrogen receptors and the estrogen tells breasts to grow. And so we happen to have a lot of estrogen receptors on our breasts. We need to deposit fat on our bodies in order to sustain these pregnancies. And so that's where the fat ends up. It ends up in our breast tissue. It could be that breasts are just these happy accidents of fat deposition, which doesn't sound very sexy, does it?
No, it doesn't. So leaving aside breast augmentation, which I'm definitely going to get into in a minute, there is a huge variation in breast sizes that we see in humans that you really don't see anywhere else in the animal kingdom. What is up with that?
Yeah, we think that breasts are kind of one of the most variable, you know, traits that we have. And it's really interesting because, of course, we live in a culture now where we're told over and over again that big breasts are better. You know, this started in the dawn, you know, the dawn of breast surgery augmentation. Women were actually told that they really should have big breasts in order to feel like women. And so we're told this, but in fact, you know, nature designed a great variety of breast sizes. And it turns out that they're all really spectacularly good at breastfeeding. really doesn't matter how small your breasts are, because what happens is your breasts actually grow and they keep developing throughout your pregnancy. In fact, it's one the last growing organ in our body. Breasts don't finish kind of growing up until our last trimesters of pregnancy. And some breasts actually almost double in size during pregnancy, and the mammary gland grows so that it really is capable of producing milk.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking with Rochelle Saunders, and we're speaking with Florence Williams about her new book, Breasts, A Natural and Unnatural History. And speaking of unnatural, I definitely want to talk about breast implants, because this was one of the most interesting and the most horrifying parts of your book.
It's funny. For most of human history, women thought their breasts were too big. And in fact, women, you know, they had to work. They had to work in the fields. They had to get around. And if women had very big breasts, it was quite inconvenient. It was only really with the rise of Hollywood, you know, in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, that large breasts became sort of fetishized and celebrated. The first silicone breast implant was invented exactly 50 years ago, in 1962. And it was invented by a doctor who was holding a new silicone bag of blood. Before that, bags of blood were made out of glass, or I should say containers of blood were made out of glass. And he was holding this warm bag of blood. This is a doctor in Houston, Texas, of course. And he said to himself, "My, that feels like a breast. Why don't we see what happens if we put it in a woman's breast tissue?" And so first they implanted this silicone bag of gel in a dog named Esmeralda, and the dog chewed it out. She was not happy with it at all. And then they were looking for a human subject. They found one, a woman who had come into a public hospital in Houston actually to have some tattoos removed from her breasts. And it turns out this woman is still alive 50 years later. I found her outside of Houston, and she actually still has the original breast implants in her breasts. They've been in her body for 50 years, which is really unusual because we know that breast implants have a shelf life. You know, they usually only last about 10 or 20 years before they get hard. And unfortunately, hers have hardened also, and they've ruptured actually, but she doesn't want to get them removed because it's such a major operation to get them out. It's actually called an explantation.
Wow. So what I found the horrifying part of this is there was really no regulation or sort of real experimental process. It was just like, try it in a dog. Okay, let's find a person.
Yes. And before there were breast implants, the silicone implants, there were silicone injections. And this was a practice that appears to have been invented actually in American-occupied Japan after World War II, where Japanese prostitutes were injecting silicone found on the military bases. So this was industrial-grade silicone. They were injecting it into their breasts in order to get bigger breasts. And that was really horrific. I mean, they caused infections. They caused gangrene. The silicone migrated sort of all over the body and got lumpy. And then, of course, we know that once the silicone was encased in a bag in the breast, those bags also ruptured. And some of the same problems happened with migrating silicone. So it's been this kind of, you know, trial and error, I guess, on women's bodies. And it has not always been well regulated. It hasn't been always well sort of thought out. So before they were putting silicone in women's breasts, they were putting things like sponges, kitchen sponges in women's breasts, and glass balls. You know, there's been sort of long, sorry history of experimentation.
I wish everybody listening could see how wide my eyebrows are right now.
You know, you would think now we would be over this and just be using very, very safe implant materials. And that's what I thought until I heard about a French company just last year, where the CEO of this French company was actually arrested because he was using cheaper industrial grade silicone in his implants that he was selling. These were called PIP implants, and many hundreds of thousands of women all over Europe are now suing this manufacturer, and they're complaining of problems from these implants. He was using silicone that was not sort of medically approved, but silicone that was taken right out of industrial processes.
Not only as well what was being implanted, but to some extent, some of the medical ethics going on as well. There was one surgeon that you talked about who was making his own decisions about what size a patient should be.
Yes, you often see, and I often would hear about, surgeons actually pressuring women to get larger implants than they asked for. And usually this happened when the patient was still awake, but there is a surgeon in Houston who in the, 60s and 70s was just going ahead and putting in implants that he thought would look best. And in some cases, he was even redoing the surgery while the patient was still out because he thought she should look bigger. One nurse told me that doctors know cc's, but they don't know c's, as in cup size. And so when a doctor says, I'm giving you a C, sometimes he's really giving her a double D.
Right. So I am crossing my fingers and hoping that the state of breast implant regulation is much better today.
You would be surprised. It's actually not that much better today. I will say that the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, has studied implants very exhaustively and has concluded that they are probably safe, but that they still need to be studied. And so women who get implants now are automatically enrolled in scientific studies and they are being followed. I read some of the first reports of research coming out of these studies, and there are still a lot of problems with implants. Many of these women require reoperations. The implants don't take well. They harden within 3 to 5 years sometimes, which is very soon. Sometimes there are problems with the implants looking uneven or even dropping sort of once they're in the breast. And the internet has, of course, all kinds of funny names for some of these visual problems, such as double bubble. That's when it drops sort of below the fold of the breast. Or there's a condition called uniboob, in which the implants sort of migrate together. Sometimes that's also called bread loafing. So, you know, you can imagine sometimes what this looks like. And I think more seriously, too, many women are complaining of trouble with nipple sensation. So they're actually losing sensation in their nipples, which is a significant problem because, of course, it affects your sexual satisfaction. And so you're trying to look sexier, but you're actually functioning in a less sexual way. And then it can also have implications for your ability to breastfeed later on. And then the other thing is now we know that women with implants are sometimes not able to see breast cancer in a mammogram. And so it looks like it's harder to detect cancer in women with implants as well. So, you know, you're sort of buying into this lifetime of different kinds of more expensive breast cancer screenings, such as MRIs instead of mammograms. You're buying into many reoperations, you know, potentially every 5 to 10 years. And I think these are things that a lot of women are not really told or informed about when they sign up.
And yet, even after all of this, the breast plant industry seems to be booming.
It is booming. And it's also fair to say that a lot of women who get implants are very, very happy with them. And I think a lot of people in their lives seem to be happy with them, too. So there's, you know, there's this funny disconnect where there's a lot of satisfaction, but there are also a lot of medical problems. So, you know, I find that interesting, too, you know, that the culture sort of tells us that these are things that make us happy. And so they do.
I'm curious, you spent a chapter talking about breast augmentation in your book, but there was no mention there really of breast reduction surgery, which is becoming something that's happening more often as well. Did your research sort of shed any light on any of that?
Yes, I think at one point I discussed that for every 3 implants, augmentations, there's 1 reduction. So there are about 300,000 boob jobs a year and about 100,000 reductions. So that's interesting, too, and tells me that a lot of women are just not happy with the way things are. You know, we're never totally satisfied. I think also a lot of women find large breasts really to be literally a pain in the neck. And so and another thing I talk about in the book is that naturally breasts are getting bigger as we get fatter. And we all know that American bodies are getting fatter. And so some of that's happening in our breasts. So women actually have bigger breasts than they used to. And a lot of women, you know, are not happy with this.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking with Rochelle Saunders. And we'll be back to talk more about breasts, cancer, and the controversial potential causes in just a minute.
Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
You welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Rochelle Saunders, guest hosting today for Desiree Schell. We're here with Florence Williams, award-winning journalist and author of the new book, Breasts, A Natural and Unnatural History, named Notable Book of 2012 by the New York Times and nominated for a Los Angeles Times Book Prize. So since we're talking about breasts getting bigger, let's also talk a little bit about young girls going into puberty sooner and they're getting breasts earlier.
That's right. In my book, I really look at how modern life has changed breasts. And one of the ways is that breasts are getting bigger. Another is that we are filling them sometimes with silicone. And another, I think, you know, a topic of greater concern is that breasts are arriving earlier than ever before. We sort of know this anecdotally. You know, women talk about seeing girls, you know, in third grade, fourth grade, developing breasts. This is kind of earlier than we remember when we were kids. But now it's been also really proven in the research too, and confirmed in the research that this is happening. And it should concern us for a couple of reasons. One is that we know that early puberty is associated with breast cancer risk later on. Another is that we know that young girls who develop sort of ahead of their peers are at higher risk for things like sexual abuse and depression and substance abuse. You know, I think it's just, it's harder to be different from your peers. And it's also hard, of course, to be different in a very sexually sort of visual way when you are so young and just not ready to kind of handle that.
So let's talk a little bit about the link between early puberty and breast cancer. How do we know what's going on here?
We have studied women who have breast cancer, and we've asked them, you know, at what age did they reach puberty? And it looks like there's a 50% higher risk of breast cancer if you go through puberty before the age of 12 compared to women who go through puberty later. So that's a substantial increase, 50% higher increase. And unfortunately, many, many girls are now going through puberty well before the age of 12. In fact, 42% of African American girls are developing breasts by their ninth birthday, 30% of Hispanic girls by their ninth birthday, and 18% of white girls. And these are much bigger numbers than 10 or 15 years ago.
So is this something that is restricted to North America, or is this also popping up in other places in the world?
It's also occurring in Western Europe. It looks like it's occurring in many industrialized countries. So, you know, the question is why, and is this perhaps also linked to our diets and to obesity? Because we know that obesity rates have tripled in 6 to 11-year-olds just since 1974. And there is a link between body fat and the age of puberty. However, it doesn't seem to explain the whole phenomenon. There was a really interesting study coming out of Denmark that showed that girls were developing breasts 11 months earlier than just 15 years ago. And yet, there in Denmark, anyway, the body fat of these girls had not changed at all.
There has also been some research done about how pregnancy can actually reduce your risk of breast cancer. But it seems there's some caveats there.
There are some caveats. We know that women who have children at younger ages, around the age of 20, have a much lower risk of breast cancer than women who have children in their 30s. However, there's a short-term increased risk for 3 to 5 years after pregnancy. You know, in the long run, pregnancy confers a benefit, but in the short run, there's also a risk of breast cancer after a pregnancy, and that's sort of regardless of age.
So, what's actually going on here? I know the breast goes sort of changes when we get pregnant, but what's actually happening?
Yeah, it looks like there's some really interesting changes going on in the breast cells. I mentioned earlier that your breasts don't really finish developing until the third trimester of pregnancy. And it looks like there's something that actually happens to those cells once they reach their sort of fully developed stage. Before that point, they're still stem cells, and they're still kind of figuring out what to do, and they're hanging out, being vulnerable to carcinogens. And it's only after the final trimester of pregnancy that they reach the sort of end of their developmental blueprint. And that seems to confer a benefit to them. It kind of armors them against carcinogens.
So if you never get pregnant, does that mean your breasts never fully develop?
That's right. And in fact, breast cancer used to be known as a disease of nuns. And that's because the nuns never got pregnant. And they got breast cancer at much higher rates than anyone else. We also know, though, that unfortunately, women who go through pregnancy later have about the same, and by later I mean, you know, age 35, have about the same risk as women who have never had children at all.
So this is a lot about the timing.
It's a lot about the timing. And I think one of the reasons that women who have late pregnancies are at risk is because they have this sort of long window of vulnerability in which those breast cells are not developed. And that's when our bodies are hit with a lot of carcinogens, you know, in our environment or natural carcinogens. You know, we know radiation is a cause of breast cancer. We are now seeing links between certain pesticides and women who were exposed as younger women and the developing of breast cancer later on. Researchers are certainly interested in finding out more about environmental factors in breast cancer. It's an area of research that sadly has been quite neglected.
Now, you also mentioned in your book something about research that's being done to potentially create like a drug that would sort of give you the side effect of becoming pregnant without the actual baby part.
Well, there are a couple of scientists out there who are saying, if pregnancy armors our breasts, and it does this, you know, if we get pregnant when we're 20, but we don't actually want to be pregnant when we're 20, maybe we could take a drug or a pill that just mimics pregnancy and can trick our breasts into thinking that we're pregnant, and therefore kind of armoring the breast tissue. So maybe if we give women this huge hit of estrogen, then their breasts would be protected. And so it's really a controversial idea because, as we all know, you know, taking hormones is fraught with all kinds of problems. You know, we now know that hormone replacement therapy, which women take in menopause, is it ups your breast cancer risk. It's associated with higher breast cancer rates. We know that actually birth control pills taken in teenage years, especially the high-dose ones that women took in the 1960s and 70s, those are also associated with an increased breast cancer risk, although these are modest increases. But the idea of taking high doses of hormones, you know, gives a lot of people pause. So this is something that I think has to be studied really, really carefully.
It definitely sounds controversial. Now, would some of these, for example, with the pill, is the risk big enough that we should be sort of concerned about it?
It looks like it's not really. You know, the contraceptive pills that we have on the market today are so much lower dose than the ones that were around in the 70s and 80s. I think they're sort of one-fifth the hormone levels of the pill from the 70s and 80s today. And we know that, of course, pregnancy carries a lot of health risks as well as sort of, you know, life phase complications. So it looks like for most women, the benefits of these kinds of hormonal contraceptives really outweigh the risks. But it's also worth discussing with your doctor sort of what your family history is of breast cancer. You may not be a great candidate for a hormonal birth control or any other kind of hormonal drug, you know, if there's a lot of breast cancer in your family.
This is Skeptically Speaking. I'm Rochelle Saunders, here discussing the new book, Breasts, A Natural and Unnatural History, with author Florence Williams. When it comes to breasts and breast cancer, and specifically the risk factors, it seems like really nothing is clear-cut. Why don't we know what causes breast cancer?
That's a great question. I know we all wish we did know that. We do know that breast cancer rates have increased about 40% in the last 40 years. We know that breast cancer rates are supposed to increase dramatically in the rest of the world as the rest of the world industrializes. Currently, breast cancer is the largest killer of women globally, It's the second largest cancer killer of women in the United States. So I think we'd all like to find a cause. And unfortunately, the way dollars have been allocated in this field is that there's so much money that's been going into breast cancer detection, breast cancer awareness, and those things are really great and important. But we now know that our breast cancer detection methods are actually very flawed. You know, mammography is not what we'd like it to be. Unfortunately, it seems that mammography does not really improve our survival rates as much as we would like. Especially for women under 50, we know that mammography is very unreliable. Unfortunately, women under 50 just have dense breasts, and it's hard for the mammograms to see through that tissue. So we've poured so much money into detection, so much into breast cancer awareness, when really all along it would have been nice if we had been spending a little bit more money on prevention and trying to figure out what might be causing breast cancer. So fortunately, there are a lot of consumer groups and women's groups, activist groups, environmental groups who are really demanding sort of more government funding, more private funding, more foundation funding going into this now. And I think you will see more of it occurring in the next 10 years.
You mentioned breast density, and you actually talk a little bit about this in the book, but how does breast density play into risk factors for breast cancer?
Yeah, that's an interesting one, too. I in the book, I describe density as being the biggest risk factor you've never heard of. Most women have no idea whether they have dense breasts or not. It's not something we're typically told after we get a mammogram or a physical exam. But it turns out that breast density is actually one of the biggest risk factors for breast cancer. We don't really know why this is, but there may be some relationship between breast density and hormones or hormone responsiveness in our tissue. And we know that a lot of breast cancers are sort of fed by hormones.
What is a dense breast?
A dense breast is one that has more mammary gland in the breast and less fat, relatively. And as we age, this is supposed to change. We're supposed to have our mammary glands sort of replaced by fat, which is why mammograms work better in older women over 50. But in some women, the gland sort of sticks around a lot longer and doesn't get replaced by as much fat. So some women just have much denser breasts. And so you might want to find out, you know, the next time you get a mammogram, you might want to ask your radiologist or ask your doctor, you know, do I fall into this category of having very dense breasts? And it looks like fewer than a quarter of all women fall into this category. But if you do, it might be worth knowing, because there are other ways to detect breast cancer, such as ultrasound, such as MRI, and these might be better for these women.
So if I find out that I have particularly dense breasts, is there anything I can do about it?
Well, it's something you should discuss with your doctor, but it might make sense for you to get an MRI or an ultrasound instead of an annual mammogram.
But is there anything I can do to, like, reduce the density of my breast?
Oh, no.
Oh.
There doesn't seem to be, unfortunately.
Darn.
Although, if you're taking hormone replacement therapy, that is one of the things that increases the density of your breasts. As soon as the minute you stop taking hormone replacement therapy, your breasts become less dense. And so that may be one of the reasons, you know, hormone replacement therapy is linked to breast cancer. So if you're taking any kind of hormonal pharmaceutical and it is causing very, very dense breasts, it's something you might want to re-examine.
Since we're on the topic of cancer, I was actually really surprised to read the chapter you included in your book about breast cancer in men, which I had never really thought about, you don't really hear about. Can you tell us about Camp Lejeune?
Breast cancer in men is a very rare disease. It only occurs at 1% the rate that it occurs in women. So there are about 40,000 women in the United States who die of breast cancer every year, and only about 4,000 men. Camp Lejeune is a military base for the Marine Corps in North Carolina. And for about 35 years, we now know it had the most contaminated public groundwater system ever found in the United States. About 750,000 people lived or worked on this base during that time period and were drinking this water or swimming in the water or bathing in the water. And now many health problems are emerging in this population, including leukemia, kidney cancers, also all sorts of problems. But among the diseases is male breast cancer. And there are now 80 men who have emerged and come forward that they've actually managed to find themselves because no one else was looking for them. And some of these men are young. They're in their 20s, 30s, and 40s, which is very unusual. And they have become very active in, you know, sort of demanding that someone study them and try to find out if there is, in fact, a link between the groundwater contamination and their cancer. And they've been very successful. Congress has actually now allotted $20 million to study this population. There have been some great media coverage about these men. And, you know, it's not easy for a Marine to come forward and say, I have breast cancer. So I found these men to be really compelling, just brave men, you know, who are really, you know, facing this, the fact that they have a so-called women's disease and helping to publicize it.
Do we know what the groundwater was contaminated with?
Yeah, we do. It was contaminated with a number of solvents, including perchloroethylene, vinyl chloride, trichloroethylene, and benzene. These are all industrial solvents that are linked to many cancers and diseases. They have not ever before been linked to breast cancer. It's very hard actually to determine whether a particular industrial substance is linked to a disease. And when we have a cluster like this emerging, it can be very, very helpful to the science. So sadly, these men, a lot of them have this disease, but the upside is that they really may help advance the science. I think it's sort of ironic that the men may actually help solve some of the puzzles of a women's disease. But it's because it's so rare in men that they become a much easier population to study.
So this could actually reveal or help us understand breast cancer in women.
It absolutely could. It absolutely could.
Now, before we finish, I do want to talk briefly about environmental and possible chemical causes of breast cancer, which is a focus of a lot of research going right now. In particular, the endocrine disrupting chemicals. What are they?
Endocrine disrupting chemicals are chemicals that are known to interact in some way with our hormone receptors. The cells in our body are filled with hormone receptors. Almost every biological process in our body is sort of governed by hormones, whether it's metabolism, reproduction, stress, all of these things are influenced by hormones. Our breast tissue is filled with estrogen receptors, and we know that breast cancer is sometimes fed by estrogen, and it looks like also progesterone. So the other thing we're learning, unfortunately, is that many industrial compounds in our environment look a lot like these hormones and can confuse our receptors. So they can sit on our receptors in our cells, or they can activate the receptors in our cells, or in some cases, they can block the receptors in our cells. And all these things have the potential to affect biological processes and systems. It's very hard to study it in humans, but we've been studying it in rodents for a long time. And in rodents, we can see that certain chemicals are linked to, for example, early puberty, or are linked to breast cancer, or are linked to thyroid problems in mice, such as flame retardants, which I mentioned at the beginning of the show. We found flame retardants in my breast milk. And virtually all Americans have some level of flame retardants coursing through our bloodstreams. And this is because the substances are so common in our homes and in our offices. And unfortunately, one of the very common classes of flame retardants called PBDEs appears to interact with thyroid hormones and thyroid receptors. And so now we have some human data, too, showing that, for example, pregnant women with higher levels of these industrial compounds in their bodies have a longer time to pregnancy. So it took them longer to get pregnant. We're seeing some impacts in their infants. For example, later these infants are being studied for things like IQ levels. So a lot of these studies are preliminary. A lot of them are just ongoing. And I think we'll know a lot more about how humans are affected by these chemicals in the future.
The research done on this topic so far seems to have produced a lot of conflicting conclusions and a lot of just sort of murky data. Is there any consensus going on here, or is the jury still out?
That's a great question. I think there is an emerging consensus among scientists. I like to compare it to sort of where global warming science was 15 or 20 years ago. You know, there's this increasing preponderance of evidence. But there is also some conflicting evidence, and there are some scientists who, you know, really disagree kind of with what other scientists are saying. You know, it's a really fraught topic because when you start looking at how to regulate industrial chemicals, of course, there's a vested interest among industry not to regulate them. And so industry scientists tend to find and to kind of, you know, glom onto one set of data, and the academic or more independent scientists tend to find another set of data. And the regulators are really caught in the middle. The regulators have been testing chemicals in the same way, you know, since the 1940s and 50s. They have not been looking at endocrine disruptors. They have not been looking at toxicity tests that even show hormonal endpoints. For example, they have not been looking at whether a mouse develops breast cancer. They have not been looking at whether a mouse has fertility problems or has mating problems or has IQ problems or has prostate problems. So there are a lot of other scientists who say, you know, maybe we ought to incorporate some of these tests into the way we test and regulate industrial chemicals. So it has been a huge debate, not resolved.
There have been a couple of studies that have been called out, I've read in the literature, because some of the rats and mice that they've exposed to these chemicals have actually been given a way higher dose than a human would ever be expected to kind of be exposed to in the normal course of their lives. Do we know what happens with some of the smaller, more sort of average doses?
The way toxicity tests are typically done is they are administered at very high doses. And then when you stop seeing a very dramatic effect, such as death, then you just assume anything below that level of a substance is safe. And so typically, low doses of chemicals have never been tested. But weirdly, with endocrine-disrupting chemicals or hormone-disrupting chemicals, they seem to actually do the most damage at very low levels, some of which seem to be very relevant to the levels that normal people are exposed to all the time. And again, you know, the EPA and the FDA are hotly debating these topics really at this very moment and trying to determine if they need to change the testing protocols that they do and to include more low-dose levels in their tests. But it's really expensive, you know, to do these tests at lots of different doses. You need thousands of animals. And so no one is very happy about changing the way they do things.
I can't imagine making sort of taking this data that we do on experiments with mice and rats is easy to kind of transcend to results in humans, since it's so much harder to control in human populations.
And that's why I think the human data is going to be much more powerful. It's very new and recent that we have been able to actually look inside our breast milk or look inside our bloodstreams to see what chemicals are in there and at what levels. So we now have this tool that we've never had before. So we know, you know, what people are exposed to, and we know what diseases they're getting. So if we know how to look for the human data, that can be very powerful. And I think we'll see just more and more of that, and we'll be using more and more of it as a guide. And in fact, in Europe, they're already doing more of that.
Are we actually sort of following people, a large group of people, from kind of infancy and when they're getting breast milk and what's in there right through to as they get older, since breast cancer is something that pops up sort of in an older population? Are we actually following these people through their entire life cycle?
Individual researchers are following cohorts of people. There are some great studies going on in San Francisco. There have been great ones at Michigan looking at, for example, cord blood in women who have just given birth. You can examine their cord blood. Often the cord blood is frozen. You can study it later, or you can study it at the time, and then you can follow the infants as they grow up and see what happens to them. The CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, is also doing a fantastic set of studies looking at over 200 industrial compounds in a wide cross-section of Americans all over the country. And they do these studies every 2 years, and you can actually see the results online. And you can find out sort of what the average level for, say, a plasticizer or a flame retardant is in a six-year-old girl. And then you can, you know, you can see how it changes over time. It still remains a question whether those exact individuals will be followed throughout their entire adult lifetimes. It's something a lot of scientists would like to see more funding going into.
It definitely seems like a question that is difficult to solve in any other way.
Yes, I think that's right. I think it's going to be really important to provide the human data, or else, you know, it's hard to convince people to really believe what happens in a mouse. It's a lot easier if you can say, wow, here we have a whole population exposed to, you know, radiation from a weapons factory, and we know what happened to them 30 years later. That's much more powerful.
Yeah, from the brief amount of research I've been able to do, it seems like the jury is really still out on this topic.
Yes, but I think it's really a rich topic and one that we would all like to see more resources poured into.
Florence, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
If you want to learn more about Florence Williams or her book, Breasts, A Natural and Unnatural History, you can visit her website at florencewilliams.wordpress.com. You'll be able to find that link on our website, skepticallyspeaking.com, in the show notes for today's episode.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're looking at the aging process and how science and medicine are treating it as a problem to be solved. We'll talk to Michael Rose, professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the School of Biological Sciences at the University of California, Irvine, about the evolution of aging. And we'll speak to Alex Zavarankov, creator of the Aging Research Portfolio and author of The Ageless Generation, How Advances in Biomedicine Will Transform the Global Economy. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm Desiree Schell. Today, we are obviously talking about breasts. And as you all know, when the science is sexy or weird, or frequently both, we call PsyCurious, the wonderfully pseudonymed blogger who writes at Neurotic Physiology on the Scientopia blog network and the PsyCurious Brain on scientificamerican.com. Hello again, Psy.
Hi. I prefer to think of it as whenever the science is salacious.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's a tagline.
Yep.
Okay, so tell us about the French bra study that seemed to be everywhere in the news a few weeks ago.
I was seeing all these articles. It's by this author, I think Rouillon is the pronunciation, and he's out of France. He is a sports medicine physiologist. He studies sports medicine, and he's been following 320 women for the past year, some of whom have been going without bras. In the latest release of the data, he says that without wearing a bra, your nipple will rise as opposed to sinking by about 7 millimeters, which is about a quarter of an inch. Yeah, so that's interesting to a lot of people because, you know, most people wear bras in the hope that, you know, they'll make the girls look perky.
Right.
Or make them, you know, continue to be perky longer than they might be otherwise. But in fact, according to the study, that is no longer the case.
Well, let's break this down. Okay, so first of all, how did he study the breasts exactly?
That's actually an interesting question because we don't really know. This science, and it's totally science, but it has not been published yet. This is something that we like to call science by press release. And it's not even necessarily Rouillon's fault that this happened. You know, sometimes, for example, you'll be at a conference and the media will ask about your work. Often science does get reported before it has been, you know, released under peer review, published in a journal. And that's fine, but it does mean that you don't get the details that you might get otherwise.
Right.
It also means that if there are problems, you may not know what they are because, you know, it hasn't been peer reviewed for any issues. But in this case, there's a lot of details missing from this study.
And let's just go back for a moment. So, but this is science, but really all you're working from is a press release. But he also was doing interviews about that press release.
Yes. And so he was doing interviews about the press release. I mean, you know, if you're asked, you're going to do the interview. So according to the interviews provided, he was measuring boobs with calipers. And the measure is the distance of the nipple from the shoulder. The tip of the nipple, I assume. He had half of his people, his women, they were all women between the ages of 18 and 35. And he had half of them go without a bra for a year. and looked at with the calipers either before or after. Or see, that's the thing, is we don't know when he was looking with the calipers and what the 7 millimeter rise is in comparison to. Like, are they 7 millimeters more perky than they were before? Are they 7 millimeters more perky in comparison with the group that wore bras? Do maybe the women who are, you know, less perky, maybe they've just been doing a lot of weights and their shoulders are bigger?
Well, and that's actually, and you wrote a blog post on this, and actually you mentioned that you would have taken into account their pectoral muscles.
Yes. Yeah. So for example, I do a lot of weightlifting. And since I have, man, my pecs are buff now, and it's, it shows.
As it were.
and you know, also pectorals are some of the muscles that actually hold the boobs pert. That's one of the things that side effects of having good pecs is having, you know, pert boobs or moobs if you're dudes.
Right.
That's the technical term.
Right.
And of course, the other thing that holds the breast pert is actually a set of small, very small, actually, ligaments called Cooper's ligaments that surround the breast and help it fight gravity, as it were. And so their hypothesis is actually that when you wear a bra, if you wear a bra most of the time, your Cooper's ligaments and your pecs have basically nothing to do. And if you snooze, you lose. And if you don't use it, you lose it. And so the idea that they are proposing is that the Cooper's ligaments and the pectoral muscles have become weak because of our nefarious bras, and that they are causing boob sag due to our weak ligaments.
In specifically women that are 18 to 35 years old.
Women between 18 and 35, yes.
So yeah, there seem to be some problems with this. Also,
I don't know if there are problems. I'll have to see when the study is published. It could just be a lack of detail.
Right. Well, and also you do mention in your post that the cup size was not noted, which could have an impact.
Yes, and actually, so I've since found out they've had, in addition to the press release, they had one woman giving testimony about how great it was to go without a bra, and she stands straighter, and she has less back pain, and all this kind of stuff. And I was like, okay, well, they have this one person, and they're quoting her over and over again. I've since found out she's a distance runner. She's apparently been running without a bra for, you know, however long that's been.
Wow.
Yeah, that's what I said. And she's an A cup.
Well, that would explain some things.
Yeah.
So is this plausible? Because I guess to me, I'm kind of confused, because wouldn't this actually defy the laws of physics, gravity specifically? The idea that if you don't wear a bra, you reduce the sag. But the sag is somewhat caused by gravity, is it not?
Well, I think the question here is that the reduction in sag is relative. Boobs will sag because age happens and because gravity is cruel. I think the question here is that the change in sag, if that is indeed what is being measured in this study, is the result of increases in strength of things like the Cooper's ligaments. So if you're not wearing a bra, you're going to have more bounce to your step, you might say, and that this gives your Cooper's ligaments a workout, and they will be stronger than they might be otherwise and better able to resist gravity, and this might keep you more pert. Is the concept. You will sag. You know, it's not like if you go without a bra, you're going to look 18 at 40. You won't. That's just life. But the idea is that relatively speaking, it might be better.
So plausible.
I would say it is not implausible. Yeah.
All right. And again, so would there be a difference between, and I'm assuming there would, if he only measured 18 to 35 year olds, what about older women? What would the impact there be?
So he actually has noted in the press releases and in his interviews, he's like, if you're 42 and you've had 3 kids, keep the bra. There's nothing can help you now. That's not the words he uses. No power on earth can age you. But I think that's the thing, is like, you know, if you're young, maybe going braless could help build up your Cooper's ligaments, according to him. And of course, I mean, that remains to be seen. I'm not sure if they're measuring things like the strength of the pectoral muscles, or if they can measure the amount of elastin in the Cooper's ligaments and therefore how, you know, strong they might be. So it generally remains to be seen. But basically, once age and gravity have gotten a hold of you, they aren't going to let go.
And see, this story was presented to me in a very interesting way in the media, just because it was presented as one more science story that is probably misinterpreted and is probably crap. But that isn't necessarily the case.
That's the thing, though, because it hasn't actually been released, I don't know. It could be. It could not be. And then there's also the question of whether or not your bra actually prevents your boobs from sagging in general. Does it matter? This is about aesthetics. You know, saggy boobs are just as functional as non-saggy boobs. So I think this is really more of a question of aesthetics. Also, there's a bunch of people asking the question of what this means for things like back pain.
Right.
For women with extremely large breasts. And again, we don't know what that means. We don't even know the average cup size of the women he was measuring. They could all have been under a C cup, you know, in which case, I mean, what does that mean?
When will we know these things?
Oh, when it's published, if it's ever published, and I hope it will be. The press release has noted that he's starting out on a 15-year study, and the women have only been measured for 1 year. So it is possible that we will be waiting a long time. I have to imagine, though, that after the media attention this has received, he may be going to publication sooner rather than later.
One would assume.
Yeah. You know, before the study loses perk.
Oh.
You want it to remain young and bouncy.
Oh, okay. I have all the puns right now. All the puns, and I am holding back. You are welcome. All right, so enough of boobs for the moment. Because
it's too bad.
I know. It's hard. So we have one last thing to discuss, though, which I consider very important. Now, our audience has always known you by your pseudonym, Psycurious. And maybe just give us some background. Where did that start?
So it started when I started blogging, like you do on the internet, I started my own blog, and I was like, well, you know, I want to write under a pseudonym, and I had various reasons, one of which is that I am an animal researcher, and we come in for a certain amount of flack. Another is that I was then a young woman in science, and I wanted to be able to discuss things in my expertise without people questioning me because I was young and female. So there are various reasons, but I was looking around for a pseudonym and I was kind of, you know, chatting it over, and Psycurious came up, and I was like, okay, that's just kind of awesome. And I kept it.
Well, and you've been going by Psycurious for how long?
5 years.
That's longer than a lot of things I could think about. But so from my understanding, that time has come to an end.
It has. Yes. So I'm starting to, really want to take my writing more professionally, and, you know, get out there with my work. So people still don't want pseudonyms, you know, necessarily in the byline. It's kind of people get weird about it.
So why now specifically?
Well, I had a lot of, you know, reasons when I started, but recently a lot of the animal research flack has decreased, which has been nice. I am no longer a young woman in science.
Aww.
I have a PhD now. And, you know, but also I want to be able to go more professional. I think my writing has reached the point where I can do that. And so it's more that the desire to really, you know, stand behind all of my work and say, yeah, I did that, is much stronger now than, you know, it was previously.
So what's your name?
My name is Bethany Brookshire.
I just heard a chorus of angels.
It means so much to people.
Well, does it not mean that much to you? Like, how do you feel about saying that on air?
You know, it's fine. What's in a name, you know? The work of Psycurious is the work of Psycurious. And it always will be. Whether or not there's a legal name that, you know, sounds like it belongs to a white chick associated with it.
So I can keep calling you Psycurious, though?
Of course you can. I hope you will. It's much more interesting.
Sai, as always, wonderful to have you here, and congratulations on coming out.
Oh, thank you.
You can find Psycurious at Neurotic Physiology or the Psycurious Brain on scientificamerican.com or by clicking the links on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also find links to Twitter, Facebook, Google+, and iTunes, which will, of course, help you maintain your recommended dose of Skeptically Speaking. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced and distributed by Suburban Panic Media. Our guest coordinators are Rochelle Saunders and Ed Haynes. Our social media manager is Chelsea Butler. Helen Quivillon is our publications coordinator. Ryan Bromsgrove is our production manager and assistant editor. Josh Witten is our researcher. The show is edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by AOK. And I'm your host, Desiree Shell.